When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And it is a very nice Father's Day Sunday morning out there. What passes for the cool time of day? It's not cool, but it's certainly going to get a lot hotter. I'll put it that way. Hope you've been outside this morning, maybe took a walk, or maybe you're sitting out there enjoying that first cup of coffee or tea or whatever your morning beverage is. Anyway, don't forget all the important guys in life, whether it's dad, just your four-legged friends, or you've got kids all over the world. It's just a very important day that we celebrate our fathers and how much they've meant to us over the years. And the ones that are with us now, the ones that have gone on, we still need to remember them. And anyway, it's just a great day to celebrate that. Also, the first day of summer. It's also the longest day of the year. That's what constitutes the first day of summer. So got a lot of things to celebrate out there. Just do it wisely and drink lots of fluids and have plenty of electrolytes in there so that you feel as good at the end of the day, if somewhat tired, as you do starting out. So many things to talk about, but the most important thing is what is on your mind. And Cliff and Diane and Mac are my first three callers, and I say we just go ahead and get started with phone calls. Good morning, Cliff.
Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm off to a good start. How about yourself?
Fine. I have a couple questions about sagos.
Okay.
I've got several, and of course I've been watching to see if they all survived and sprout back, and I think the 4th of July date is still the one that's firm. One of my last ones that I had given up on, I see yesterday, has sprouted.
Sprouted from the top or sprouted from the base?
The top.
Okay, well, then you're off to a good start. The thing that, you know, is so important to realize with the sagos that some of them are going to just resume their normal growth pattern, which means putting on those, you know, stiff, dark green fronds. Others are going to, you think there's something crazy about them because the growth will just look very abnormal. And those are the ones that have decided that this is the year to go through a reproductive cycle. And, of course, the plants are separate, male and female. Female, and their reproductive cycle involves totally different structures on there. And I'm seeing a lot of the ones, so many of them are just coming out at top with fronds like normal, but I'm seeing a lot of the ones putting on new growth at the base, and they are starting to form their reproductive cones, as I guess we would call them, up on top. But they're going to come out fine. It's just going to take a while when they go into this reproductive cycle. It may be several months before they put on the first new frond. But the fact that they have growth now at this point, I'm going to tell you it means they're out of the woods. I don't think there's any question about the plant surviving. But whether it turns back into a really attractive plant immediately or whether it looks kind of weird for the next few months, at least it's alive and it will resume its normal growth, though, once it gets past the reproducing cycle.
Okay. I just got a couple of questions on... As I went through and cleaned them up, if the pups were visible, I removed the pups on those. I came to one that didn't show any signs of life, and I could not see any pups, so I just left it.
Uh-huh.
About 2 weeks ago, I see that it sprouted around the base.
Uh-huh.
21. and then it's coming out the top.
My
question is, a couple, I guess, is where are these things native, and is that the native growth for those things? And if I leave it and don't remove those ones that have sprouted, what am I going to end up with?
Well, it's the plants, you know, they're ancient plants. They were around when the dinosaurs were around. Properly, they're called cycads, and they will produce the pups at the base, and if you've got good growth coming out of the top, it's your choice whether you leave the pups or whether you take them off. If the only growth you're seeing is at the base, then you need to leave at least some of those, because you need the green fronds to, of course, carry on photosynthesis and produce and affect the carbohydrate substances that it takes the plants to live. Now, if you just let the pups come out at the base, you will end up with a sago palm that has multiple trunks. If you ever find yourself over Galveston way, you know, drive around some of those 100-year-old homes there and look at, you'll see massive plants with, you know, 6, 8, 10 trunks coming up. And it makes a big, full, pretty plant, unless you don't have room for it, in which case you can take the little ones off. But now you have an option, and that is, if you would like to have more sagos, if you would like to share with friends, you know, if you would like to just have more plants, you can actually, the little pups, as we call them, that come out at the base, can be easily grown into their own plants. But here's the deal about that. You need to wait till the absolute hottest part of the summer, which is typically mid-July to mid-August. Sago has a kind of a strange root system. They're just like a true palm, and that if you cut the roots die all the way back to the trunk of the plant, and then they start over producing new roots. But they don't produce new roots until the soil is quite warm, bordering on hot. So when you cut those little round balls, those little pups off the side of the plant, they're going to have absolutely zero roots on them. But if you just kind of cram them down into, say, a 1 gallon container of soil and kind of put a, you know, stick or something like that to anchor them in place so they don't look around, don't move around too much, most of them will form roots and just make whole new plants. 3 or 4 years ago, I helped a fellow with a big one that he wanted to do this with. I think we took 27 pups off of it, and 26 of them grew and thrived. So if you would like to start some more plants, wait until midsummer to take those off, and then you can start them again. And when you get ready to do that, if you want to call me again, we'll run through the exact process. If you don't have room for the plant to, you know, produce multiple trunks on its own, and you just want to cut off that growth, you can do so, but I would wait until you have some pretty good healthy fronds coming out of the top, just so that you know the plant can go on carrying on its photosynthesis. And I don't think I've probably seen maybe 1 out of 1,000 sagos that I've looked at, both driving by and people bringing pictures and things in. I think I've only seen one where I thought the plant was truly dead, and I'm not sure that the freeze was what caused that. So patience is the watchword here, and it sounds like you've got plenty of it. And I'd still look at the 4th of July, but it sounds to me like all of yours are showing at least some growth, which means they're going to regrow pretty quickly. They've got the root system of a big plant, so they are going to come out quickly and grow much faster than they did the first time around. So you just need to decide whether you want more plants, whether you have room to let them make multiple trunks. And in many cases, I think multiple trunks is best, because these plants are periodically going to go through that reproductive cycle. And when they do that, they don't put on any new fronds for a whole year. When you have a plant with multiple trunks, it's sort of an individual thing. One trunk may go through the reproductive cycle where all the others are putting on their normal fronds. So it just means you're going to have a beautiful plant every year. If you have a single trunked plant, the one out of every 4, 5, 6 years that it decides to reproduce, it's going to look real weird for several months through the summer. So they're native, I believe they're native to southern Mexico, Central America, down through that part of the tropics. I'd have to look that up to be sure, but I do believe they are New World plants.
Okay, well, I got ahead of myself, I guess, because I got 5 of them growing in gallon cans. Right now, so
well,
I'm gonna share those with my neighbors.
Share them with your neighbors. I tell you what, as you've probably discovered, because their slow growth rate, they're fairly expensive to go out and buy. So maybe you can set up Cliff's roadside sago stand and find other people that jumped the gun and pull theirs out because they thought they were dead. There always is a pretty good market for sago palms, but I prefer to share with friends. And sounds like you're doing it right, and you'll have the opportunity to create a bunch more if you want to.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Cliff. Goodbye. All right, let's talk to Diane. Good morning, Diane.
Hey, Bob. I can't imagine that there's more to say about sago palms, but I actually do.
It's kind of like some other issues in the news. You never have the last word because there's always, like you say, something else to say.
Well, when Cliff said he had a question about sago palm, I'm like, oh, maybe I can hang up. But no, I have more. Okay, so I've noticed this year, because I cut all the dead fronds off, and uh-huh. I've never noticed this before because, you know, you couldn't see it, that this fur develops at the top
yeah.
just as they're about to release the new fronds.
Uh-huh.
I have one. It's probably my biggest. It's in the brightest area. It's a male. I have five sagos. Two have not grown their new fronds yet. But this one in particular I want to get rid of. And
uh-huh.
I have a home who wants to adopt it. But it has gotten the fur. It's
mm-hmm.
grown some fronds off the trunk.
Uh-huh.
It has grown a forest. I'm not exaggerating when I say that. Of pups, a forest.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what I'm going to do with all. I just want to. But it hasn't grown. It's grown its fur, but not the
uh-huh.
top fronds. So, from what y'all just discussed, I thought about that. I'm like, I'm leaving the forest, so
yep.
it's feeding the father plant, the
right.
son. But when, I mean, I'm guessing it's still alive because it's growing off the trunk.
Absolutely, fronds. Absolutely.
When. And I should wait for the new home to dig this up mid-July, you're saying?
Mid-July through mid-August. And the good thing about the fact that every time you cut a root, it dies all the way back to the trunk of the plant, is you do not have to get a big root ball. You know, it's like you may see on the side of the road, you'll see palm trees that are 15 feet tall, and they've got this little, you know, root ball that would fit into a wastebasket. And your sago's the same way when you're, I tell them they can have it if they come dig it themselves, but at least you're over where you have deeper soil. But there's no need to try to get, you know, a 15-gallon size root ball on them. You want to stay, you know, maybe 2-3 inches out from the trunk. But don't worry about breaking up the root system because it's all going to die anyway when you transplant it.
Right.
But if you wait.
I told them that.
But yeah.
The forest, okay, all these pups growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I only wanted them to dig, like you said, like an inch away. Because it's
uh-huh.
all going to die, because I'm putting a fig tree in here, and I don't want the
okay.
crater to have to backfill. But I don't know if they're going to be able to do that with all these pups, because there's so many.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to make things ugly on a temporary basis to have beauty later on. And what it may amount to is that if we looked at this forest of growth, you may just have to take the pruning shears and, you know, cut away a number of those fronds just to be able to get to it. If you cut the outer ones so you can get to the, you know, to the ground underneath it, you're still going to leave the ones that are growing upwards or growing back toward the trunk of the, hard to know whether to call it a mother or a father plant, but the host plant, shall we say. And it may just involve doing a little bit of pruning, and it may mean some lopsided pups for a little while, but they will grow out of that. And at this point, you know, transplanting successfully is going to be the primary objective, and if it looks a little weird for the first year, so be it. Does that make sense?
Okay, yes. So for now, I leave all the pups.
Yeah, yeah, just
okay.
leave everything as is, and then when it's time to transplant, you give it as much of a haircut as needed. You wear thick gloves and eye protection, and you let the recipient of this plant do the majority of the work.
Yeah, yeah, because it's free. But they have to do all the work.
You have to realize that to go out and buy a plant that size would be several hundred dollars. Could easily be $600 or $800. I am not seeing the plant to tell you that, but you're making a very generous donation to a friend. You don't have to tell them that you're getting ready to dig it out and throw it away anyway. But, yeah, it's going to be a job. And as you, I'm sure, have discovered, they produce very sharp little spines down at the, you know, base where those fronds come out. So just please be careful in doing it. We don't need any additional puncture wounds.
Yeah, it's like 4.5 feet tall. So you're right. It's a
yeah.
It's a male. So okay, But with the pups, when they dig it out, say I've cut back a bunch of them at that point, mm-hmm. like the day before they come, I leave the ones closest to so they can decide what they want to do those. But are those going to come? I cut them back in, around my other plants, mm-hmm. but they keep coming back. How do I make that stop?
Unfortunately, it's a normal part of the cycle, and hopefully we're not going to have the stressful weather that we had this year. You know, a plant, and I'm not going to give them conscious thought, although I think they're smarter than some of the people I hear on the news lately, but the plant senses that it has been put under severe stress when we have a winter like this, and its immediate response is grow as much as I can, reproduce as much as I can, because I don't know what's going on, but I might not survive. So the plant knows best, and it just it's a normal reaction to a plant that has been stressed, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. I mean, if you're not planning to save the little pups and try to root them, you can take your pruning shears and just keep cutting off the new growth as it comes out from the base. But I'd sure wait until you have a good crop of leaves up on top before you do that, because we're seeing plants, we're seeing what we expected, and that some plants that came out on the top, mainly woody trees and big shrubs, they came out, looked like they were going to be fine, and then the stressful weather hit, now they're folding up and dying because there was too much damage to the trunk tissue, to the xylem, to the cambium, to the phloem especially. That's not going to happen with the sago because its vascular system is totally different. The xylem and phloem are in little bundles that are scattered throughout the stem, so it's not likely that the sago's really suffered a whole lot of cold damage to the trunk. If they're coming out on top, they're probably going to be just fine. But the only way to really, you know, cut back or to reduce all that growth coming out at ground level is just to remove it when it shows up.
Okay. Can I ask you another quick question?
Go right ahead.
Why does the crepe myrtle shed, and why is it super shedding this year?
It's, you know, it's just simply an evolutionary thing that some plants, rather than hold their bark, just evolved, and who knows why. You'd have to be a much better paleobotanist than me to figure it all out. But some plants, rather than form a thick bark, they just constantly shed that bark. It does not form the same attachment to the layer underneath, and it's just what they do. I suspect that maybe last year they didn't shed as much bark for whatever, and with the cold they just said, hey, we're going to get rid of all this old dead skin we've got on here. I think sycamores are doing the same thing. I'm seeing more coming off of the sycamores than I've seen in a long time, and it's, I can say it's probably weather related, but it's perfectly normal and does not indicate any problem with the plant.
I was just curious, as I was peeling all that off and mulching under my loquats. It's amazing mm-hmm. mulch, and I have 14 Basham Party pinks that are 20 years old. So,
yeah, big trees.
Got a lot of bark.
Yep. And we're going to just have to see how the loquats do. I just haven't had time to do it. We've got some here at the nursery that we kind of inherited when we bought the property next to us. And they've got so much bark that is totally peeled off of them. I just wonder how much live tissue there is underneath. And I need to just go slice into it and see. But if the tissue underneath it was badly damaged, those loquats, the whole top may die out on them, you know, as the weather stays hot and dry, and hopefully the new growth will come out from the base. And again, we're just going to have to wait till mid-July to make that judgment. So on the loquats, I don't know whether that's normal or not. On the crepe myrtles and things like sycamores, it definitely is normal. And I believe you said crepe myrtles initially starting out, but loquats, they shed some bark, but certainly not like a crepe myrtle. And we're just going to have to see how much of that is cold damage.
My loquats aren't shedding. I'm putting the... They're coming back.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I got you.
I'm mulching them with the crepe myrtle bark because I have 14 crepe myrtles.
Yeah.
They're already pink, so they're huge. So I have so much skin.
You have 14 mulch factories.
Yeah. I've put about 6 wheelbarrows full of bark under there, and it's great.
Yeah.
Great mulch. So, Okay, Bob, I'll let you get on to your next caller. Thank you so much.
And next time we have a chance to visit, I'll share some additional things we learned with our long visit with David Vaughn this week that I think a biologist like yourself would find interesting. So, as always, I look forward to our next time to get together, Diane. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Certainly. Goodbye. All right, need to get a break in here, and I get to talk about Cedar Eater of Texas. Talk about something that sheds bark and makes a mess and all. Best thing you can do is call the Cedar Eater and get rid of that cedar, and he will turn it into a nice mulch for you with a nice big machine that shreds it up beautifully. You know, ash juniper, what we call cedar, is just the scourge of the hill country. If it just didn't get so big and thick, and I leave the big ones, you know, they have a place in nature. They are used by various wildlife. But this second growth cedar that comes out all over your land is just stealing the sunlight, holding the water, not letting it through to the soil underneath, and you really need to get rid of it. And the most environmentally friendly way I know of to do that is to call the Cedar Eater. No bulldozing, no burning, no scraping the land. That machine may turn over a rock or two, but it's not like getting out there with a skid steer. Cedar Eater can clear acres and acres in a single day, and you wind up with a wonderful amount of mulch. I mean, they do work for all the state agencies. Just everybody in the business knows that the Cedar Eater is simply the best at what they do. They will get in and hand cut if you have a lot of cedar up real close to the trees you want to protect. They send in that hand clearing crew and they simply cut it, drag it out in the open, and that machine just almost instantly makes it into another big pile of mulch. So many services they also have if you lost trees in the freeze, if you lost big trees that you're afraid of falling or losing limbs out of. They have a bigger machine called the Wilt Eater that can take care of those for you very safely, very quickly. Lots of services. To learn more, just give them a call. 210-745-2743. That's 210-745-2743 for the Cedar Eater of Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Mac is up first. Good morning, Mac.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
And I do not have a palm question.
All questions are welcome.
Well, I do have four quick questions that I'll get through because I know you have callers. I wanted to ask you, I got at my nursery that I trade with, I got a product. I've been having a tick problem.
Yes.
And I got a problem called Dr. Earth's Last Stop.
Okay.
It's an insect spray that says it's harmless to pets and humans.
Does it say what it contains?
It contained different oils.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I was wondering if you had ever heard of that.
I don't know it by that name, but it sounds like it's similar to the product we used to get called Bioganic, and that seems to be the most effective way to go after ticks once they're up out of the ground. Now, over the winter months, you can get rid of ticks with the beneficial nematodes, but once they're up on the foliage of the plants, we have to use something else, and herbal oils have seemed to be the very best. Thyme oil seems to be the best of the best, and that's what it sounds like this product's based on. You'll need to be careful to only spray in the cool part of the day because any oil can cause some burning, but should be bad for the ticks and just fine for the pets and plants.
Well, that's good. And another thing I got was I had gotten some fertile loam with BT.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, is that effective for squash bugs?
It is effective for the larval state. Now, but do you mean squash bugs or do you mean vine borers?
Well, vine borers.
Okay, yeah. It's effective against the vine borers, but you can't just spray it on the plants. You have to inject it into the stem. But there's a difference in squash bugs and squash vine borer. Squash bugs are a totally different. They start out as a gray juvenile, and then they light gray, and then they turn much darker color. They damage the squash through sucking it, and it would not be effective at all against squash bugs. But squash vine borers injected into the stem, that's the best way I've found to stop them.
Okay. I had given up on planting squash. I think I mentioned this to you before. I had given up on planting squash because I've always had trouble with them.
Right.
And in a moment of weakness, I planted some squash, and I've actually gotten some yellow squash.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also suffered with the bugs, though. And what they do is, I'm not familiar with treating them or even really what I'm dealing with. And what mm-hmm. they do is they get inside the plant, and it sucks the squash from the inside. It's like a inner tube losing its air.
Oh, yeah. 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 And then the plant just folds up and dies overnight. Yeah. And that's, the only way I've really found to treat that is just, if you're comfortable with a syringe, get, you know, one with a fairly big bore needle. If not, get one of these, things that people use to inject, seasonings into chickens and turkeys and things before they put them on the grill. But, the yellow squash has an especially hollow stem, and it's real easy just to stick it in. And, I make it a fairly good concentrate. I'll take about a cup of water and put maybe a tablespoon of BT in there, and I find injecting that into the squash stems kills the squash borers very effectively.
Do those squash borers do they get into white squash?
They get into any squash that has a thick stem. They don't usually get into the long season squash, and they don't get into the little tatumi squash, the ones we call calabacita. But any squash that has a larger diameter stem, the squash vine borers can be an issue. It's an egg that's laid by a kind of a weird looking moth. The moth looks more like a wasp than it does like a moth. But they lay the eggs right down close to where the stem emerges from the ground. They hatch, they bore into the stem, and that's where the problem starts.
Yes, that's, well, I tell you, they're insidious little creatures.
Yeah.
And I've been looking for the calabacita squash seeds, and that has been a problem. They have been hard to find.
Well, I know David's Garden Seed has them. If you go online to David's Garden Seed, they're actually here in San Antonio, but they ship all over the country. And David has them, and he will get them to your doorstep.
Okay, well, that helped me. And the third question I have, I goofed on something. I got some cayenne pepper plants.
Uh-huh.
And I had them in my pickup, and I wasn't driving with the AC on all day. I had to be parked, and I did not think that they would have got that hot, but they ended up getting scorched pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about, is there any particular thing I can do to those? I haven't put them out yet. But
I'd get them planted, and I'd water them in with Super Thrive. That's the best thing I've ever found to a plant that's really been badly shocked. I've seen it bring back plants that I thought were done for.
Okay. And if you don't have any, for some reason I've had trouble defining Super Thrive.
Uh-huh.
Would regular has to grow work?
Not as well. It would certainly help, but just about any nursery out there should have Super Thrive. Comes a little brown bottle with a yellow label that reads like snake oil, and it's apparently very high in B vitamins. It's a proprietary formula that's in there, but it sure does smell like B vitamins. But don't buy a big jug of it. It's too expensive, but you don't need much. Use just like a cap full of it to a watering can full of water, and you should be able to get it in a little small bottle, and any decent nursery should have it on the shelves.
Okay. Well, and my last question, as far as stuff putting out after the freeze, I've noticed that, as you said, that patience really does play a part, because I've had several potted plants that were exposed, mm-hmm. and I'd given up on them, and they, lo and behold, they've put out. And one of them was a cane yucca I have.
Uh-huh.
And that cane yucca, one of my dogs broke off a stem of it, and I replanted it. And it, so I was kind of proud of this plant. And then the dog froze back, and it's putting out from the base. And I've never had one of those before. I'm wondering, is it okay if I get just like a garden saw and saw the dead cane off?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, it's just, it's pretty woody. So do it carefully and try not to break up or disturb the roots in doing it, because it's sometimes a little hard to hold it still. But I use my battery-powered chainsaw to do things like that because it's just more manageable than a handsaw or a big gas saw. But anyway, cut it off slowly and safely, and your plant will look nicer. Won't make any difference to how it grows, but it'll look a whole lot nicer.
Well, I appreciate that, and something on the pruning that that I'd like to pass on. I found out a relative of mine told me that DeWalt makes a pruning blade for their zip saws.
Uh-huh.
And he said that that was really a good blade. It was really handy for pruning.
Uh-huh.
And so I got one, and lo and behold, the day I got that blade, I saw a guy cleaning out a fence along the road. And he had a little generator in the back of his pickup, and he was out there with a zip saw clean out the fence. So I just wanted to pass that on, thank you for that.
I'm a bigger fan of Bosch than I am DeWalt, because their batteries don't last. But whatever works for you is good. Mac, I'll let you go. Let me get a break out of the way here so I can. You're certainly welcome. Move on, talk to Reese and Thomas. I can talk about Wild Birds Unlimited, and today is Father's Day. If you haven't figured out what to get for Dad, well, just kind of play a little dumb and say, well, you know, I was going to get you a really good gift, but I thought instead we'd just go over to Wild Birds Unlimited, and I'd let you pick out your own present. You don't have to admit that you forgot that it was Father's Day. And let me tell you, I can't think of a better place for most of the dads out there to go shopping for something fun. Even if Dad's not a birder, Wild Birds Unlimited has lots of things that you would enjoy having around the garden, or, you know, good pair of binoculars. They've got wonderful optics at very, very reasonable prices. It's just amazing how many different beautiful things you're going to find in that one moderate-sized store. And, of course, they're always happy to help. Gift certificates are available, and for folks who are into birding, you're never going to find better quality products. Things like hummingbird feeders that have a little built-in moat to stop the ants, things like thistle feeders for that Niger seed that brings in all the beautiful finches, and well, the seed mixes themselves too. Kyle and his staff know which seed mixes exclude things like the doves and all that you don't want around and yet are very attractive to the songbirds that you do want to have around. They are the pros when it comes to feeding birds, and so much more. Open 7 days a week to serve you. Easy to find out there at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner. I think it's the Huebner Rope Shopping Center. I think that's what it's called. And Wild Birds Unlimited is in the section that actually faces Northwest Military. So get out and see them. And if you have any questions, give them a call. 479-BIRD. That's an easy number to remember. 210-479-BIRD for our friends at Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. My next three callers are Reese and Thomas and Mary, and Reese is up next. Good morning, Reese. Good morning. Yes.
Can you hear me, Bob?
I hear you just fine now.
Okay. I have a question about roses. In my garden, I have both knockout as well as some old-fashioned roses.
Okay.
Problems with knockouts like I do with the other ones, although I fertilize it regularly with Growing Green, alternating with Has to Grow, spraying with liquid garlic and whole ground cornmeal. Now I'm beginning to notice some black spots on the leaves. And what causes it and how to control?
Well, what you're looking at is a fungus disease that has an easy name to remember. It's called black spot fungus. And it is spread, the spores that cause this disease spread through the air, and there are many more spores in the air at night than there are during the day. And if the spore lands on a dry leaf, nothing happens, but if it lands on a wet leaf, then it germinates, penetrates the leaf, and that's when you get this started. Now, it's not fatal. It doesn't spread through the plant. It just disfigures the leaves. But this is one reason that we like to try to keep the foliage wet, keep it dried off at night. We try to do our watering during the day so the leaves have time to dry before night. And then we have a month like we've had where we get a lot of nighttime rains. The leaves stay wet all the time, and we get a lot of black spot fungus showing up. So the hot, dry weather will largely control it on its own. If you want to get rid of it a little bit faster, there are various sprays you could use. Neem will help reduce it. You can use sodium bicarbonate, just baking soda. The thing that we use most often is soaking the whole ground cornmeal in water for 24 hours and then just using that to spray the leaves, and that will keep it under control. Now, you should find that the new growth that's coming out on your roses now will probably not have the black spot. Most of the leaves that got the black spot are the ones that were, you know, on the plants when we had all those wonderful spring rains and just kept the plants wet, wet, wet. But very common, but it's not a fatal disease. It's a nuisance rather than a real severe issue, and I think you're going to find that now that it's turned off hotter and drier, you're going to see a lot less of it.
Oh, great. That's good to know. The other question is about foxtail. You know, I have one growing in a pot. It's getting huge.
Uh-huh.
And I would
yes.
like to plant it in the ground. So
go right ahead.
Sort of shade or partial light?
It will grow wherever you want to plant it, Reese. It will grow in anything from full blazing sun to just bright shade, and it'll be happy anywhere. In the sun, it will make a little bit more compact plant. The fox tails don't get as long in the bright sun. The sunlight tends to break down a hormone that makes the cell stretch. But it is a very, very versatile plant, and you just plant it wherever you think it'll look nice, and it'll be fine.
Great. Thank you so much. And happy Thanksgiving to all the listeners out there, Bob.
You mean Father's Day.
Yeah.
Very good, Reese. Thank you so very much. And, well, you're welcome. It's already up past 8:45. Means I got to do another quick break, and then it'll be Thomas and Mary. I get to talk for a moment about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And, you know, Fanix wants to remind you they are having a very special Father's Day sale going on yesterday and today. And that is all their Traeger pellet grills and accessories. Those are 10% off. And all that phenomenal Ego battery-powered equipment, it is all 10% off. And let me tell you, if you're looking for something Dad would really enjoy, everybody hates a lawnmower that you have to really work and work and work to get it started. Everybody hates a weed eater or even a chainsaw that it's more trouble to start it than it is to use it. You just need to discover the magic of lithium-ion battery-powered equipment. And Fanix has a good line of the Ego battery-powered material. What a great Father's Day gift that would make. And 10% off, well, that can be a pretty good savings. Fanix is also getting more and more crepe myrtles in all the time. They are known for crepe myrtles through the summer months. They've also got things like plumerias. They've got a lot of blooming perennials that fall into the categories that you can use your credits from the Water Saver rebate program that Saws offers. I could go on and on. They've got all the organic gardening supplies, the safe fertilizer for summer months. Fanix is just a fun place to visit with over 10 acres of beautiful nursery over there, sitting right the same spot they've been for well over 80 years now, over on Home Green Road, open 7 days a week to serve you at Fanix Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Thomas and Mary are my next two callers. I actually do have an open line, so if you want to dial 210-599-5555, you can get on the list as well. Right now, we say good morning to Thomas. How are you, sir? Happy Father's Day.
Yes. Well, my wife's got a Phanaenopsis orchid.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know a thing about them. I've heard you talk about them, but I wasn't interested enough to pay attention.
Well, Phalaenopsis orchids are one of the easiest orchids to grow. This time of year, it's very important that you keep them away from ceiling fans, and you don't want the duct from that air conditioning system blowing on them. They don't like dry air blowing on them, so it won't hurt the plant, but the flowers won't last nearly as long. It's not uncommon for the flowers on a Phalaenopsis orchid to last as long as 6 weeks or sometimes even longer. So, but first of all, a plant needs to stay not under a ceiling fan and not where the AC vent blows on it. It does need to be in a bright window, needs to be very watered very thoroughly whenever that top surface dries out. Most of the ones you buy these days are growing in a sphagnum moss material, which holds water for some time. But just very bright light, water it real thoroughly when the pot starts feeling a little bit lightweight, and feed it fairly often. I like something like Medina's Has to Grow is what I use. In my greenhouse, and I've grown, we used to grow Phalaenopsis orchids commercially. We used to grow like 30,000 plants a year. So I can tell you a lot about growing those little orchids, but they don't have the water storage organs that some other types of orchids do, so you can't ever allow them to totally dry out. But keep them in a bright window, water them and fertilize them. They'll be pretty for a long time. Now, eventually the flowers will fall off on that bloom spike. Don't cut the bloom spike off until it turns brown and crispy, because many times that original bloom spike will put out a branch and put on some more flowers. Once it does turn sort of a light tannish brown, then that one's through. You can cut that bloom spike off, and in its own season, the plant will start a new bloom spike from down between a couple of the leaves. But that's sort of Phalaenopsis 101.
Well, Bob, this plant... And look real pretty till, now it's been a good while. But anyway, all of them dropped off. But it doesn't, and it's in a pot. It doesn't have any drain holes or anything. It's just in a real pretty ceramic type of pot, but there's no drain holes.
Well, now, normally, if you lift up on the plant, you're going to find it's actually in a little clear plastic pot that you haven't noticed, and they just set it down into that pot that doesn't drain. It does need drainage, so, but try lifting up on it. I think you'll find that it is in a pot sort of sitting down into the decorative pot. I would always take it out of the decorative pot to water it, let it drain well, and then put it back into that decorative pot if you like. But at this point, like I say, that old bloom spike may put on some more blooms, or when it's ready, the plant will actually start a whole new bloom spike. So plenty of light, plenty of fertilizer, and just pull it out of the decorative pot to water it, and I'm pretty sure you're going to find it is in a little clear plastic pot.
Okay, I've got one more question. I got a Hong Kong orchid tree. This year, I couldn't wrap it or anything. I was in the hospital when we had all this cold.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought the thing was done. It froze back. And it was
right.
Pretty good size. It's about a 5-year, six-year-old tree.
Uh-huh.
But now it put out about 20 shoots from the very bottom.
Yeah.
I mean, they're long and leggy, but some of them are right on the ground.
Uh-huh. We'll leave about
those up where I can, have someone when they mow, they won't mow over those shoots.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you've got 20 little sprouts coming out, I'd only leave about 5 of them. I would trim the rest of them off unless you just want a giant bush. But they're pretty supple, pretty limber when they're young. So, yes, if you want to tie them more upright, you certainly can. But what we've done on our tree here at the nursery, and I need to get out and do it again, is really thin out all those little shoots and just leave a few of them so it'll come up and it'll be more upright in its growth habit. But, it'll come back. It'll be about a year before it blooms, but it will get back to its original glory.
I can tie them up.
Yes, sir.
About 5 of them.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob. Well, that's what I want to know.
It's my pleasure to talk to you, Thomas. Hope it...
How long have you been on the air now?
Oh, over 40 years. I haven't really kept up with it.
I think it was 1991 I started listening to you.
Well, I've been on a little while longer. I remember I was on the air before we opened Shades of Green, and we opened Shades of Green 40 years ago. So did a brief stint with that other radio station and didn't like the way of doing business. But KTSA talked me into going with them when they went news talk. And I'll just say it's been a long time. I don't remember exactly how long, but it's been a long, long journey with a lot of fun, lots of nice people along the way, Thomas. So I appreciate it. Let me get Mary in here before the news break. Good morning, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Bob. Quick question.
Good morning.
About my century plant. I thought it made it through the freeze.
Right.
I trimmed it real good, and it came back, and then I noticed it kind of leaning.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized that the base of it was just all mush and rotted.
Yep.
But the fronds or the leaves are still good.
Uh-huh.
Is there any... can you plant those?
Has did it put up the big bloom spike in the middle?
No.
Okay. Typically, agaves, century plants, reproduce from little shoots that come out at the base of the plants. You won't see them. They actually come out underground. And the individual leaves can't be rooted. But most of the time, you're going to see anywhere from 5 to 50 new little plants start coming up within a couple of feet of the base of the plant that has rotted away. So just... leave them and let them grow. If you want to dig some of them and move them elsewhere, you can certainly do so. But what is left there, no, that's probably not going to do anything. But more than likely, within the next 3 to 6 months, you're going to start seeing some new plants come up around where the big plant was. And you can either leave them, just let them grow where they are, or transplant them.
Yeah, those are gone because something got to them. Something was digging them up. But anyway, I wanted to tell you real quick. Yesterday, I was listening to you, and I thought there was a little kitty that was in my property, and I kept trying to find it, but it was on the radio. I searched for that kitty for about a half an hour.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Well, as our operations manager says, your show sounds like it's real. People definitely know it's a real show. And if you need a little kitty, there's a very cute little orange kitty that is looking for a good home. And he was quite vocal this morning when I got to the nursery. But sweet little creature. But if you were, you know, somebody looking for a little one, he is eating solid food, but he just turned up and can't turn away a little hungry creature. So, but that's a great story, Mary.
I think my hubby would disown me if I
Don't know about that. Well, I've got to go to news. Thank you for sharing that.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Oh, just realized I might have misspoken on Dr. Williamson's phone numbers. 341-2569, 341-2569. Just got too many things going on. We're going to talk to Dan and E.T. and Pete. Let's just get right back to the phone calls. Good morning, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I have a question about my palm tree. I guess I'm like so many other people. I topped it. Right after the cold weather was over.
Uh-huh.
And there's nothing going on that I can see. And I know the 4th of July is the drop dead date, supposedly. What do you think? You think it's gone?
Now, in topping it, do you mean you cut the fronds off or you actually took the top of the palm tree off?
Just the fronds.
Okay, yeah. It's, you know, I would have expected to see a bit of new growth by now, but I would still, again, I'm having people tell me that they, you know, palms that they thought were dead are coming back. I think, is this a real big tree? How tall is it?
I'd say 30 feet.
Okay, no, I don't want you up in the top of that. If it were a lower tree, I would tell you that you can actually, you know, feel the trunk. And if it feels soft and squishy, then it's probably not coming back. But I don't want you that high up on off the ground on something that really we'll know very shortly. I would consider the 4th of July, which is still, what, roughly 3 weeks away. If it hadn't put out by then, it probably is not coming back. And there, the main ones that aren't coming back, the so-called queen palms, I don't think hardly any of those survived. The Washingtonias, Some of them are coming back, some of them aren't. I'd feel better if you had some growth by now, but I wouldn't totally give up on it for a couple of weeks.
All right, sir. One other question. I know you've given out in the past a recipe for natural weed killer.
Right.
Could you do that again, please?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We use a strong vinegar. If you're buying it at the grocery store, you can buy the pickling vinegar, which I believe is going to be 9% as opposed to the regular 5%. If you've got really tough weeds, then you may want to go to a nursery and get the 20% vinegar. Substantially more expensive, but just the stronger the vinegar, the faster it works. To that vinegar, you add 2 jiggers of orange oil, which is probably called delimonene. I think the best on the market is from Medina. And it has many other uses, but we add 2 ounces of orange oil to 1 gallon of vinegar. Usually just add a little squirt of dish soap. Sometimes we'll add a little bit of molasses. Seems to make it work a little better sometimes, but no water. You're just going to use this vinegar orange oil mix as a spray. You're not soaking the soil. You're just spraying the foliage. So a gallon of spray will cover a lot of ground. You'll see effects within 5 or 10 minutes, and it will give you a pretty good kill. Now, on a really tough weed, like Bermuda grass or Johnson grass, you may have to spray more than once. And you want to be spraying green foliage. If you're in an area that didn't get good rains or if things are really drying out, water first, because the more active growth the weed is in, the faster it will die.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, and happy Father's Day to you, buddy.
And to you as well, Dan. I sure appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, next up is E.T. Good morning, E.T.
Good morning, Bob. How are you today?
It's just a beautiful Father's Day morning out there. It's going to be hot before it's over with, but this is Texas. This is the end of June. It's supposed to be that way.
I hear that. Okay. Since the feast, some of my container plants, I believe they're gone. So if I dump all of them all out, like in a wheelbarrow, big tub, what can I amend the soil with?
I would just add a little bit of compost and maybe a little dry fertilizer. I mean, if you really want to go overboard, you could add some green sand, you could add some azomite, but the principal thing you'll be adding is compost, and good soil doesn't wear out. There's nothing wrong with that soil just because the plants froze, but by all means, I'd certainly reuse it. Like I say, the first thing I'd add is some compost, and then beyond that, if you want to add just the same things we would add if we were planting in the ground, it'll make it even better.
Okay, if the root system, maybe got some, you know, pot-bound roots, can I still use them, or just chunk them in a compost pile or something?
I would throw the root system into the compost pile, but shake off all the soil that you possibly can. And, you know, a year from now, you can mix that compost back in with the next pot you create. But for now, I would put the roots proper into compost for a while before you reincorporate them into the soil.
Okay. And ticks. I'm working in an area that have bunches of ticks, you know, and I pick them up on me myself. What's the best preventative from getting them on you, and the best way to take them off and to treat the bite?
Well, they're any real good insect repellent. The same things that repel mosquitoes will repel ticks. Now, I don't like the ones that have the neurotoxins, the ones that have the DEET in them. I use one called Murphy's Natural, but any good mosquito repellent will also be repellent to the ticks. Now, I think, you know, anytime I've been out working in tick country, which is basically my ranch, I'll shower as quickly as possible after I come in and try to get them off. Hopefully, you'll get them before they start digging in. If they have dug in, then, you know, you probably want to go online and look at the 2 or 3 different ways they suggest getting them out. But you do want to get them off of you as quickly as possible, because many of them do carry Lyme disease and a couple of other potential problems. Now, they don't transfer it immediately. Apparently, it takes several hours for them to really, the disease tends to reside in what they call the hindgut of the tick. So it's not like if you get a tick and, you know, an hour later you find it and get rid of it, probably it's not giving you any problems. But you certainly don't want to give them time to really get dig in and get attached. If they're just lightly attached, you can take them out with, you know, just a pair of tweezers.
Ointment or putting on the bite.
I use something that I get at Rhonda's Nature's Way. It's called Comfrey Trauma Cream or Trauma Cream or something like that. It's a sort of a salve that has comfrey in it. It takes the itch out almost instantly, and it really does help with healing.
Okay. And yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, I was watching Texas Gardener or Texas Central Gardener, and he talked about rain barrels. He said the best way to keep mosquitoes out is just take regular old window screening, you know, and put it over top, and it keeps up debris also.
I would agree with that. The small rain barrels that I have and that I've seen, they actually have, you know, just a little screen on top. Now, obviously the mosquito has to have a way to get into the barrel if it's going to lay eggs and make more mosquitoes. So, yes, anything you can do to screen it will certainly keep that from happening. If you get mosquito larvae in there, don't dump the water. You can get rid of the mosquito larvae with just a few drops of orange oil will kill the mosquito larvae. Or you can use one of these materials that contains what we call BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. That's a bacteria that kills mosquito larvae without hurting anything else. So there are lots of ways to get rid of them, but like you say, the best thing to do is just prevent them in the first place, and window screen will sure keep the mosquitoes out so they can't lay the eggs to begin with.
That BTI is the same thing for caterpillars?
No, it's regular BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, is for caterpillars. It's a special strain of it they found in Israel, which is why it's called BT israeliensis. That's the one that gets the larvae of the mosquitoes and of the fungus gnats.
Okay, Bob, well, thank you very much, and you have a great day.
You do the same, sir. Thank you. Goodbye. All right. Yeah, get ready to get a quick break in here. Pete, you'll be up first after I talk about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. Once again, I just really sometimes scratch my head when I hear all the ads, ad after ad, about repairing your roof after the hailstorm, or repairing your roof after the freeze, or repairing your roof after whatever. I just say to myself, why doesn't everyone simply get a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on their home and stop worrying about it? It truly is not that much more expensive, just slightly more expensive than a regular composition roof, and it is truly a lifetime quality roof. They use the best material in the business. They give you the best warranty in the industry, and I certainly have lots and lots of years of experience having had one of the roofs on my home for, I guess it's getting close to 20 years now. Never a single problem. Here at Shades of Green, before we knew about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, we had had another roofing company, supposedly reputable, put on a metal roof which rusted out. They refused to stand behind the guarantee, so by that time, we had just learned about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. We had them put on a good roof. Not one single problem since then, despite the fact that we had huge hailstorms, stones one year. I just love Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and I love the fact that you're going to save money on your insurance, save money on your utility bills every month, that you have some extra fire protection built in when you have a good metal roof. There's just a lot of reasons to choose the last roof you'll ever put on your home, and that's going to be a roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and there are many different styles, many different looks to the roof, so just give them a call, learn what all your different options are. 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster.
News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Pete and Carol and Mike, and Pete is up first. Good morning, Pete.
Morning, Bob. How are you doing today, sir?
Father's Day is off to a good start for me. How about yourself?
Yeah, same here. Happy
Very good. Thank you.
Hey, Bob, I called you a while back about some grass. I threw out 5 pallets of St. Augustine palmetto.
Yes, sir.
And Some of it's in direct sunlight and it's thriving really well, but some of the other spots in the yard are shaded, and the grass is kind of spindly there, and I can still see the undergrowth, and it's kind of brownish.
Okay.
Still, you know.
Have you you rolled it when you put it out, right?
Yes.
Okay. Have you fertilized?
I used some Medina.
Okay, and how long ago was that?
Maybe a month ago.
Okay. In this at this point, you know, it's going to basically be wait and see. There are, palmetto is one of the best grasses around for shade, but there are areas that just, you know, it gets so shady it doesn't get as thick. You may need to think about doing a little bit of thinning out on some of those trees just to get a little more sunlight to it. But there's no substitute for sunlight. And if it's looking really good in the sun but not quite so good in the shadier areas, it may just be a little slower to become established, to thicken up. But if we look at it another 6 weeks from now and it's still kind of thin, at that point I'd think about thinning the trees just a bit to get a little bit more sunlight to it.
Okay. Also, the outside, as far as what would you recommend for, you know, maybe spraying the yard for when the kids go out for mosquitoes?
There are actually about three different choices. You can use a garlic spray. There's one called Garlic Barrier. The same company makes one they call Mosquito Barrier. The garlicky aroma goes away immediately, but it continues to repel mosquitoes usually for at least 24 hours. A little longer lasting is a cedar oil spray. There's a good one out there called Cedar Repel. It's by Nature's Creation. Problem is everybody's buying it right now and maybe a little bit hard to find, but I love the cedar oil spray, and it will frequently last for several days. And then finally, if you have any orange oil, you want to make it relatively dilute, no more than about a tablespoon per gallon, because if you make too concentrated, you could actually get a little bit of foliar burn. But about a tablespoon per gallon, you can spray that orange oil around, and you'll be mosquito-free for several hours.
All righty, Bob. Well, that's some good information there. And as far as that cedar, or what was it, the cedar oil, who did you say that was available through?
It's called Cedar Repel, and any company that carries the products by Nature's Creation, they are the ones that will have it. Right now, they just don't have much in the warehouse. We sold out of it last week, and they're telling us it'll be a week or two before we get more. But I know places like Rainbow Gardens carries all the Nature's Creation products. So I just call around. You're going to find it, and it's totally safe and very, very effective.
All righty. All right, Bob. Thank you again, and you have a happy Father's Day.
You do the same, Pete. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Goodbye.
Yes,
all right. Carol is up next. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a crepe myrtle that has been in the ground for over 30 years. It's about 20 to 25 feet high. It has three trunks.
Okay.
The bark is falling off the trunks. Also, you know, those little shoots that come up from the bottom periodically, the leaves on those shoots, there's a white substance on the leaves.
Okay.
So what? I don't recall the bark ever falling off, but I don't remember. It's been in the ground so long.
Well, the bark falling off is totally normal. The crepe myrtle seemed to be shedding an unusually large amount of bark, but it's called exfoliating bark, and that's just one of the signatures of a crepe myrtle. It is absolutely not a sign of a problem in any way, form, or fashion. It's just kind of like a lizard shedding its skin periodically, and that's what your crepe myrtle is doing. The white on the leaves is something called powdery mildew. It's very common when we have wet weather, when we have high humidity, the kind of weather we're having now where it's bright and dry. It's probably going to go away without your having to do anything. And if it's just on the little shoots down at the base, then I wouldn't really be worried about it. There is one other possibility. There's a weird little insect called a leafhopper. And in that case, it won't just be on the leaves. It'll be more more on the stems than it is on the leaves. It'll just look kind of like little dots of cotton up and down the stem. If you run your finger along there, all of a sudden a piece of that cotton will hop. It will jump. And again, they're just called leaf hoppers. They really do no damage. If you want to get rid of them, you can spray with spinosad. You can spray with a little orange oil and water. They're easy to get rid of, but they're really not causing any problem. But more commonly right now, we're seeing just the powdery mildew and many crepe myrtles, especially the older varieties. And you've had these a long time. The older varieties of crepe myrtle are a little bit more susceptible to it. We can prevent it by spraying with garlic. We can cure it by spraying with the corn water tea where we soak the cornmeal in water overnight. Or this time of year, just the fact that it's gotten dry and bright, bright sunlight, probably going to go away on its own very quickly.
Okay, well, normally I just cut those shoots off when they come
sure.
up.
That's what I do. Yeah.
Okay, I feel better. It's normal. All right.
Totally normal. Sycamores are doing the same thing, which is normal. The native persimmon is doing the same thing, which is normal. But it's like this cold weather back in February made him decide to shed an unusually large amount of bark. And seeing it all over town, but again, it happens every year. It's just not quite as obvious as it is this year. But absolutely no reason to worry.
Okay, and thanks for your advice, Bob.
Always a pleasure, Carol. Thank you for the call.
Bye.
Goodbye. All right, we've got time to talk to Mike. Good morning, Mike.
Morning. Happy Father's Day.
And to you as well, sir.
Hey, I got a question on my San Augustine yard.
Okay.
It is yellow.
And that is fairly, but it's an overall yellow. It's not a matter of the veins being darker green and the leaves being yellow?
No.
Okay. When was the last time you fertilized?
Well, that's probably what the problem is. It probably got over-fertilized back in May and April along with the wrong fertilizer.
Okay.
A month and a half ago, I put on some ironite. That didn't seem to help.
Yeah.
And then 6 weeks ago, I started listening, so I thought, I got some fader in my lenses and sprayed that on it.
Yeah.
And that seems to be helping some, but what else can I do or not do? Maybe it'd be better question.
Well, a lot of the yellowing is because we had about double what we would typically get as far as rainfall. All that water produced a real burst of growth, used up most of the nutrients the plants had, and so basically it's fertilize and be patient with it. The problem with so many of the synthetic fertilizers, or people call them chemical fertilizers, but technically everything's a chemical, but the ones that are man-made, they are used up very quickly, and the majority of the nutrient in there, probably 80% of it, just dissolves and washes away. I would feed with a product like Medina's Growing Green. It has extra green sand in it, which is more effective and longer lasting than ironite is as far as maintaining the green growth. But unlike some other problems, the yellow leaves can turn green. In some cases, if you get yellow leaves on a plant, they're never going to turn green. They're just going to fall off and be replaced by good green leaves. But on St. Augustine, that yellow, you know, can go away. If you want a little faster action, you can get, Medina makes a product they call Has to Grow Lawn. And it's just a little sprayer you hook onto the end of the hose and put it out. But I tend to like the granular fertilizers better because they last longer. They don't work overnight, but any of the good organic products. Medina makes a great one called Growing Green. Nature's Creation makes one they call Premium Lawn Food. Maestro Grow makes one they call Texas Tea. These products will both green up, and they will maintain that green throughout the summer. So does not sound like any kind of disease issue. Sounds like a lack of nutrient, perhaps a lack of zinc. Mainly the reason you're seeing it so much more is just from the large amount of rain that we had back in June. And I do is fertilize and give it a little time.
So also like the Medina product, the soil activator and molasses. I did that 2 weeks ago. How often can I repeat that?
Well, now that's not what's going to green things up. The soil activator, the molasses are going to increase the microbial life in the soil, which is going to soften your soil, which is overall going to make your plants healthier. But those things contain only a small amount of nutrients. So what you want to use is the actual fertilizer product. If you want a dry granular product, Medina makes a good one called Growing Green that you can either throw out by hand or put out with a fertilizer spreader. Or they do make a liquid that you can spray on, which is called Hastagrow Lawn. But your soil activator, Medina Plus, molasses, those things build the soil, but they don't have the direct action on the grass that a fertilizer would.
Okay, and so then my second part of that question would be is how often using the granular or the Hastagrow, do I do that on a monthly basis?
No, I do it at most every 3 months. I don't think you're just spending money you don't need to. People who are really trying to improve their yards, we would do it once a season, early spring, early summer, early fall, early winter. Once your grass is up and looking really good, you probably get away with doing it just a couple of times a year.
So you're thinking that if I come back and do it now and then...
Shouldn't have to do it again till Labor Day.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your help. Have a happy Father's Day.
You do the same, sir. Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right. Need to get a little break in here, and we will be right back with more gardening. I get to talk about the Tank Depot, and one of my earlier callers was asking about, rainwater harvest and all, and secret to being able to do well with rainwater is to have the appropriate tanks to collect and store it in. And the Tank Depot, they can help, whether you're looking for relatively small tanks or whether you have a big roof and you want to collect thousands of gallons of rain. You know, just figuring the amount of rain that we had just in June alone, if you'd had a good rainwater catchment system, you could have probably collected over 100,000 gallons of rainwater. It's just amazing how much water you can collect. But you do have to have a way to store it, and that's what Tank Depot is all about. They've got all kinds, all sizes, tanks that don't even look like rainwater harvest tanks. Plus, they have the accessories, filters you need, what we call the first flush filter. You know, they've got everything. They can even help you get the system set up. They don't do gutters, but they do just about everything else related to rainwater. And of course, they have many, many kinds of tanks, chemical storage tanks, transfer tanks, open top tanks, bait tanks, along with all those rainwater tanks. You just need to check them out. You do it online on the weekends. Simply go to tank-depot.com. And if you'd like to go see them, do that weekdays. Their sales yard is located over on Southeast Loop 410, just south of Rigsby Avenue. They are the Tank Depot.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. We're going to talk to Robert and Beverly and Frank. Oh, what a pretty Father's Day morning it is out there. First day of summer. Hope you're going to celebrate and just do it with plenty of the appropriate liquid and plenty of electrolytes. But back to the phone lines. Robert's up first. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Bob. And happy
good morning, sir.
Day to you and all the other.
All my four-legged kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
So I've sent you a couple of photos. I appreciate that you wouldn't have had time to see them yet.
I did just look at them, and it appears. Now, are these dwarf yaupons? What kind of plants are they?
Bob, I'm embarrassed to tell you I don't actually know. Before would give you a much better clue.
Okay. Well, it looks like dwarf yaupons, and you're concerned about just the dead leaf here and there through the plants?
Well, here's what happened back, maybe a month ago during the cool weather and all the rain. We did this transplant, and it looked great for 2 or 3 weeks, but it's now gone into transplant shock, I believe.
Okay.
But the leaves are all crispy, and if you grab hold of them, they'll fall off and so forth. But so, I know your broad guidance on watering is only when the soil gets dried down to, I'm going to say, 3 inches. I've never quite understood whether it's 2 or 4 or what. It's in the middle. But I
well,
think in the case of a transplant, it may need a little more reassurance. Anyway, that's the specific question, but also I have the broader question to talk to you about soil moisture and a little soil moisture meter that we found that might be of interest.
Well, first of all, back to the moisture on the plants. Yes, a plant that's transplanted recently, especially woody shrub, is going to need more water, but we don't usually apply it to the soil because with that compromised root system, the shrub has given up a lot of its ability to take up the moisture. And so what I always recommend on something like this is just take the hose and just spray over the top of the plant regularly, even several times a day if possible, because that plant will absorb a lot of moisture directly through the bark on the plant. We don't want to water the soil too often because we get so much water in the soil that it drives the oxygen out, then we lose roots, and that's not a good thing at all. But it's almost impossible to give a plant too much water when you're just spraying it onto the bark. So that's what's going to help. Now, having leaves turn brown and fall off, that's a good sign. Having leaves turn brown and stay attached to the plant, that's a bad sign. So if the leaves are falling, it indicates that the plant is probably going through its normal shock and will put new green growth on again. So I would think about using as a foliar spray a little bit of Super Thrive, maybe a little bit of Garrett juice. When it does need water again, you probably want to mix a little bit in with your water and just use that to drench the root system. But good observation that you know the plant needs more water, but the way we do that is spraying the top of the plant, not keeping the soil too terribly moist. But now, as far as overall soil moisture, that's where we kind of get into water it really, really thoroughly when you water. I say let it go until it's a knuckle or two deep, which means an inch or two deep. Certainly not ever really, really dry. You can retard the water that's lost through evaporation. Now, most of the water is actually lost through transpiration, taken up by a healthy plant and then lost out through the leaves. But on a plant with a compromised immune system, that's not going to happen. But a certain amount of water is lost just through evaporation and just a good mulch on the surface of the ground over the root system but away from the trunk. That's what's going to be best to help you maintain the soil moisture. Now, I have yet to find a soil moisture meter that I really have much confidence in, because in general what these things measure is electroconductivity, which actually in many cases is more a measure of the salt in the water than it is the actual amount of moisture in the soil. So take your readings on most of your moisture meters with a grain of salt, so to speak.
I have actually done the finger test. I mean, I take a trowel and open the soil up so I can get my fingers down in there. I don't have solid steel fingers like you do. But so far, it's actually, I'm getting more confidence in the little meter than I have my own fingers. And
well,
it's a lot easier to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. What type of meter is it?
It's just called an X-Lux. That's the brand name, and it's got a spike on it. It's about 5 or 6 inches long with a little funny-looking tip at the bottom and a little soil, you know, wet to dry meter at the top. Very easy to use. I have to tell you, I love it. Maybe it's not the right way to do it, but it sure is a whole lot easier than getting down ground.
Well, there's no doubt about that. It's just the accuracy of the readings, and it will give you a general indication, but you may need to actually just take a pot or two or three and fill with soil and just experiment with what your finger says or what Susie's finger says and as compared to what the moisture meter says, because again, most of the way those things read, they're not reading water, they're reading electroconductivity within the soil, which may or may not give you a real good idea of how much moisture's there.
But we'll try that with a pot. We have actually given it a pretty broad chest around the lawn and the garden. And I'm certainly finding it a useful tool.
Well, then, you know, my motto, if it works, do it. It might not work as well for me as it does for you, but in your soil, in your landscape, if it works, keep the fingers clean and let the probe do the work.
You got it. So thank you very much, Bob. Always great to talk to you. And please give a woof to our garden.
I will definitely do that, and you do as well to Levon and crew, and we will do the same. And Robert, it's always a good pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, next up is, I believe next up is Beverly. Good morning, Beverly.
Yes. What I'm calling about, toenail fungus, I know you say to use cornmeal, but
right.
I don't know how often and who. And so I was just wondering how often you use it and when do you stop?
Well, what you want to do is use whole ground cornmeal. You want to moisten it and let it stand for maybe 24 hours to activate this beneficial fungus called Trichoderma. And then the regimen is to soak the foot in that mixture. You're just keeping it good moist. You're not really making a paste out of it, but just well moistened, and treat the foot for about an hour a day for a week to 10 days. Now, you want to make a fresh batch of cornmeal about every 3 or 4 days, but do it every week to 10 days, or do it for a week to 10 days, then skip a week, and then do the same thing. Start it over again for about a week or 10 days. The majority of the time, it will totally eliminate it. My niece down in Mexico is a doctor, has been for many years, just a brilliant young lady, and she always teases me. She says, Uncle Bob, that's nothing new. We've been doing that for generations in the colonias in Mexico. So there are some good medical people that believe in it, and it is certainly a lot safer than the drugs that are sometimes prescribed. Now, Dr. Kirby tells me that cold laser will also work as a treatment for toenail fungus. Lots of people don't have ready access to that, but if you're going to physical therapy for any reason and they're using cold laser, get them to give you a treatment on the toes as well as on the other areas that may benefit from the cold laser. But the cornmeal is simple, cheap, and effective.
Okay, I will do that. One other thing, I hear about mosquitoes and I see all over what to do for mosquitoes, but flies.
Mm-hmm.
We have flies to come on our back porch, and then they come in the house, and I don't like that.
I don't like that either. The spinosad that we talk about, regular just plain spinosad or the spinosad soap, spinosad is a natural insecticide. It's based on, made from things from soil bacteria. Spinosad is an extraordinarily effective fly killer and totally safe for people and pets. In fact, in a different form, we actually give it orally to puppy dogs for flea control, and it works very well. So if it's safe enough for my dog to take, I'm going to feel good about spraying it around the porch. But anyway, you're not just giving spinosad to the dog. You're getting something from your vet, usually sold as Comfortis. But if it's safe enough for the pups, then it's safe enough for me. So I use the liquid spinosad. I'll usually put about an ounce to a gallon of water, just spray it around. And, I have cattle. I've got all sorts of things. So I certainly know what you're talking about with lots of flies. But spinosad is very safe and very effective.
Okay, 1 ounce to a gallon of water, and I'm going to be spraying that every day when I see.
Well, I don't think you'll have to do it every day, but I think you'll find that it will work very, very well. In your vegetable garden, in your flower beds, don't get too carried away with it because it does kill caterpillars and other things, but it may be hard on your beneficial insects. But around your porch, patio, places like that, it's the simplest, easiest, safest thing I know of.
Well, I sure thank you. And you have a nice day. Happy Father's Day.
Thank you very much, Beverly. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Goodbye. All right, quick break here, and then Frank will be up next. I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and I just love talking about Rhonda, her family, her staff, the great people over there, and all the things they do to help people. I have so many people that just tell me that they've just enjoyed better health since they got together with Rhonda and her good folks, and started looking at natural solutions to all those little aches and pains and digestive issues and maybe sleep issues, all those the problems that we all face at times. There are natural solutions for most of these things, and I don't know anyone who has the knowledge or the experience, the skill, any more than Rhonda and her folks at Rhonda's Nature's Way. They also offer therapies like the Beamer light therapy, the red light therapy, which are both widely accepted by the medical profession. Northside Store, she does reflexology sessions, and she and her staff are happy to set up a consultation with you if you'd like. Now, you know, feel free to do as I do and just go in and ask a question or two. But if you would like her or, you know, Vera, one of their great staff, to sit down, spend a little time with you, go over any medications that you may be taking now, just call to make an appointment. They do this every day, and people benefit from it every day as well. And if you're on a diet plan, you just really miss some of that material that has a little bit sweeter flavor to it, she has wonderful things. Some call smart cakes. They're a cupcake that is very, very tasty, but no great amount of sugar in there. If you're a chocoholic, like many of us are, she's got a mock fruit sweetened chocolate, dark chocolate bar that is absolutely outstanding. And you'll hear me talk all the time about the importance of keeping your electrolytes up when you're out, especially when you're working out in the heat. She carries the Ultima, which is the product I choose. All the electrolytes you need without the sugar, with great flavor as well. So many reasons. In fact, you heard me talking earlier about the trauma comfort cream that they carry. Rhonda's Nature's Way is just a very special place to help you live better naturally. Southside Stores on Southwest Military, Northside Store in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan. Both stores closed on Sunday, open other days to serve you at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Frank and Jan and Maggie, and Frank is up first. Good morning, Frank.
How's it going, Bob?
It's going well, sir. How about yourself?
Hey, doing real good, man. They had that commercial on there about your podcast and all that stuff. The cool thing about that is we can listen to you news free. There's no news or anything.
And it's probably they need to change the name. It's not really news anymore, but don't get me started on that. Mark Twain said all those years ago, he when the newspaper was the only thing around, he said, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you're misinformed. So hopefully that will not be the case with my podcast, and I appreciate it.
No, I've turned you on to so many different people, and they really they admire you, and it's great to have you on the radio. We really appreciate
it. I sincerely appreciate that. I appreciate that.
And you're going to call me crazy, but a friend of mine and I have decided to do something, and I don't know if we're wasting our time. You're going to have to tell me if we're wasting our time, Bob. We've got an escarpment cherry tree. It's in a pot. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And we're deliberating about grafting another cherry onto this escarpment and try to achieve some type of production. And we don't know where to go because we can't find any cherry trees, you know, to start off with the scion.
Right.
Because we don't know, should we spend $100-something on the internet and get this thing shipped here? And are we wasting our time, or what should we do?
I think you should buy a plane ticket and plan a little vacation in Northern California or Washington State or Oregon. And if you can call it a commercial venture, you know, it might even become deductible if this all works out. But and if you don't want to go that far, if you want to drive, you can just go to Colorado. But I honestly don't know if people have tried it before. What we have, the escarpment cherry, is, you know, same genus, just different species of cherry as compared to the sweet cherries that I've got a bag of them in the refrigerator that I, you know, right now is cherry season, and the only thing better is to actually occasionally we have business gift show or something in one of those other places where we can get them from a roadside fruit stand that they've just come off the tree. And man, I'll buy your first 10 trees if you're successful with it, and then we'll sell the next 10,000 of them at the nursery here. But it's worth a try. The one thing I would research real carefully on this is the timing, because the most fruit trees, most of the type of grafting we drew with, and I've grafted peaches and plums and pears and things like that beginning way back in my college days, but most of that has to be done during the cold season. So it's not generally a summertime graft unless there's some new things have come out that have escaped my attention. This is a project that I think has great merit, but it's not something you're going to do in July and August, so you've got a little time to do your planning there.
We used to, my dad and a friend of his, about 30 years ago, we would go and graft pecan trees for people. And
right.
We would take the scion and keep it in a refrigerator out in the barn, and then we'd go usually, I think it was late February or March.
Yeah,
and then
You typically... yes, in whip grafting, there's no reason it wouldn't work, with a cherry, and you're exactly right. You want your scion, your budwood, to be delayed in development, and that's why we put it in the refrigerator, not in the freezer. But typically, you take the graft wood December, January, and then you'll do your grafting as the sap rises, which is maybe February, maybe March. But, yeah, you're exactly right. You obviously know what you're doing with grafting. But
I just don't want to end up with some kind of Jekyll and Hyde-looking thing that's producing nothing but wasp nests on it and everything else.
Well, the only way to know is gonna try it. Again, you're dealing with the same genus of plant, so there's no reason it shouldn't take, so to speak. Now, chilling is another matter, because with peaches and everything else, we graft the best peaches out there, but the graft wood, the scion that we put on, has its own chilling requirements, which we may or may not be able to meet. In other words, in San Antonio or the near hill country, we graft all the Fredericksburg peaches we want, and they're never going to produce well because they need like 1,200 hours of chill, and we typically get about 600 hours. So I would research, and I would try to find the lowest chill, the lowest chilling on a cherry tree. And let me check my time here. I've got to go to news here in just a second. Let me get Don to put you back on hold, and we'll talk a little bit more about this and maybe another couple of ideas after the news break.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Just a beautiful Father's Day morning out there. We're going to talk a little bit more with Frank about his cherry grafting idea, and then we'll visit with Jan and Maggie. And, Frank, the one thing about it is that grafting will not change the chill requirements. And San Antonio, we are typically in a zone where we get 500 to 600 hours of chilling weather. Even this year, even though we had the extreme cold in February, 6 degrees doesn't count any more than 44 degrees does. So, if you're in the hill country, we may be up to 650, 750. But when you're doing your research and when you're looking for your cherry variety that you're going to try grafting onto the escarpment cherry, just do keep in mind and try to get the lowest chilling variety that you possibly can, because that's going to increase the chances of success here.
Yeah, that didn't even cross our mind when we were thinking about that, but... we're over here by Mike Shoup's place.
Okay.
In Burnham. I do kind of remember something we had in February. It was like a little cold
a few real chilly days, but a lot of people are saying, well, gosh, this fruit tree should be perfect this year. But the truth is, it's not how cold it gets. Chilling weather to a plant is weather below 45 degrees. And it doesn't matter whether it's 5 degrees or 30 degrees below that. It's just how many hours of that weather we get. Where you are, it's going to average about 650 hours a year. So try to get a cherry variety that... What's that?
We were explaining that to a lady a few months, well, right after that, what do they call it? Arctic, they had some damn name for it. I can't remember what it was. But we were like, it's not the... If it went down to 50 below zero, it wouldn't... Yeah. Do anything with the chilling hours. And she was adamant about going on and on, and apparently she did not listen to Dr. Webster.
Well, it's like one of my German friends says, you can tell a German, but you can't tell them much. And that applies to a much broader segment of the population. So, now I will be following your experiments, very closely, but, remember it's more than just getting a rootstock that's happy here. It's getting a scion that, will, go through its reproductive cycle, which means making those cherries that we crave here and currently have to rely on cooler climates to produce for us.
Right, because both my friend Chuck and I both suffer from gout, and the cherry juice is, one of the things that helps with preventing gout. And I don't know if you've ever had it or know anybody that's had it. It is a booger bear, man. I mean,
One of our employees suffers from it, but it goes beyond that. Any kind of arthritis, any kind of joint issues, unsweetened, but good old black cherry juice. I bet Rhonda has it on her shelves over at Rhonda's Nature's Way because, it is outstanding. I did not realize specifically for gout, but for joint issues of any sort, good old black cherry juice is delicious and very effective.
Yeah, my doctor told me that the first time I had it. He was like, you need to, get some cherries or cherry juice. And then he reminded me that the vodka that you mix with it probably wouldn't help either.
Well, and I'll tell you one more thing. I don't know about gout, but if you're looking for another juice that helps with stiff joints and things like that, pineapple juice. Don't go with the sweetened form, but pineapple juice contains something called bromelain. Pineapples are bromeliad, and that's not a very imaginative name for the substance, but it's called bromelain. Dr. Kirby even uses this in animals that have joint issues, and like I say, I don't know what it'll do with gout, but I'll tell you what, for the just pain and stiffness in your joints, I'm a big, big fan of pineapple juice along with cherry juice. So good luck with your experiment, and let us know how it works out. I'll look forward to hearing from you.
Hey, we will, and just to give you an update, my girlfriend, she had their philodendron siloam. That thing is almost 2 foot tall now. It came back, like you said it would.
Well.
I said, that thing is never coming back, but it did. I'd never grown one and didn't have any experience with the philodendron, but you and her both knew what y'all were talking about.
Well, I won't lord it over you the way she probably will, but I'm glad it came back and glad it's working out well. Greg and Frank, I appreciate it. Thank you. Don, let's move on and talk to Jan next. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
If that man gets cherries going, then maybe we can get him to work on rhubarb.
And I can think of a few other things as well. I wouldn't mind a few macadamia nuts, and they're. But it's a good excuse to go traveling and visiting our friends that live in the appropriate climates where those things grow. Unfortunately, I don't think I could live there full time, but I do enjoy the roadside produce stands when we get a chance to do that.
Yeah. Listen, I was calling. I have a friend that lives in Leon Valley. And that dang oak disease is sneaking in town that far.
Yeah.
And I was telling her about the cornmeal. So is it 1 cup to 5 gallon bucket?
Do about 2 cups. I was visiting with her friend David Vaughn. That's best arborist I've ever known, and he's saying that they're using about 2 cups per 5 gallon bucket soak overnight. And we actually just this past week were having a very, very good discussion about how it works and the fact that it does work well, but it is certainly most effective when it's used to prevent oak wilt, which it does Well, that's good. Well, the trichoderma fungus that is what grows on the cornmeal activates the tree's defense system, activates specifically a cell type called parenchyma cells, and it is very effective in preventing it. So tell her to do it. I believe they're still recommending about every 6 months for best results. And small oak tree, 3, 4, 5 inches in diameter, probably 1 5-gallon bucket is enough. Bigger trees, proportionately more. And if you're buying your cornmeal from a feed store or something like that, it's going to be pretty cheap. It'll be the best insurance you ever had against oak wilt.
Yeah, so out along the root system, you don't have to really be up by the trunk.
No, you want it up closer to the trunk, usually within 10 feet of the trunk. What we're learning, or what the soil scientists and plant physiologists are finding for us, is that while a lot of nutrient uptake takes place out toward the drip line of the trees, most of the liquid uptake takes place much closer to the trunk of the tree. So most of the application is no more than 10 feet out from the trunk of the tree.
Okay.
Makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, I'm just trying to help her save her trees.
Amen.
I told her about it like last year because I saw some dead trees on one side of Evers, and she lives on the other side in the older neighborhood.
Right.
And so I was telling her about it. Now it's crossed Evers, so now she's getting worried. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it tends to move about 100 feet a year. And that's, of course, it's doing it through the root grafting, through the unions that form between the diseased trees and the healthy trees. So that's about you can calculate about how long it'll be before it is likely up in her neighborhood. But 100 to 125 feet a year is about how fast they figure it moves.
Okay. On a ponytail palm, if you plant one outside, what's the lowest temperature you think it could stay with?
30 degrees.
30 degrees?
Yes, and the foliage will be damaged by frost, which can occur even as high as 38 degrees. But ponytails are not at all cold hardy. If you want to grow one in the yard, move to Brownsville. Biggest one I've ever seen was actually a little town called Olmito that's just outside of Brownsville. And this fella had one in his yard, and the base was a good 15 feet across. It was probably 30 feet tall. But I would recommend, if she wants to plant a ponytail in the yard, leave it in the plastic pot that it's growing in and bury it down, pot and all. It will put some roots out through the holes in the bottom of the pot. That will help with making it easier to maintain. But when cold weather arrives, and if it's just going to be a light freeze, you can just cover it with one of the row cover type fabrics like insulate. But if it's going to be a hard freeze, it'll have to come in, and rather than have to dig it up and repot it, that way you just have to dig down enough to sever the roots that have gone out through the holes in the pot. You can lift it and bring it inside, and that doesn't hurt them at all. You know, they're the great majority of the big ones you see were actually dug in northeastern Mexico, totally had all the roots removed and came across the border, and yet 99% of them come out and grow very well. So I would plant it pot and all, and then when it happens that I have to dig it up, it makes it a whole lot easier.
Right. Okay, one more question. I have a volunteer squash, and I thought it was Calabacita from last year. But no, it's an acorn squash, which I didn't grow last year. But it's about it's bigger than a softball. How do I know when to pick that?
Well, with your so-called winter squashes, in fact, with all squashes, they don't really, ripen, so to speak. The flavor doesn't change from the time they're very small until they're, full-sized. And if it is indeed an acorn-type squash, she can judge by the toughness of the skin. It is one that can be sorbed for quite a while. I tell people, look at the little stem that attaches a squash to the the vine, when that starts to crack, that squash has gotten as big and mature as it's ever going to get. Now, be aware that there are a lot of gourds out there that look, I mean, they're in the same family as squash. They look a lot alike, but they're not, they don't have nearly as good a flavor. So, look at the possibility that what you have is actually a gourd rather than an acorn squash. But if it is an acorn squash, great, more power to you. It'll take about 100 days from the time that formed until it's ready to harvest.
Okay, that sounds like the same as if a cantaloupe, the same kind of stem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, same kind of stem. Cantaloupe matures much more quickly. But your acorn squash, your butternut squash, your spaghetti squash, up north they call those winter squash, but they don't grow in the winter. They just take a much longer time to mature than the so-called summer squash like zucchinis and crooknecks and patty pans.
Yeah, I thought I'd heard that. Okay, one other question on caladium.
Yes.
They come back the next year?
You cannot rely on them. You can't rely on them too. Here's the thing about caladium bulbs. They don't like cold, wet soil. They just rot. Now, if you have taken really good care of your caladiums, if you fertilize them regularly, if you keep taking very good care of them, you can dig them up at the end of the season when cold weather approaches, dry and store the bulbs and replant them next spring. If you just plant them and let them take care of themselves, that nice big bulb's going to be a tiny little bulb, not worth saving. But so if you're really, really taking good care of them, you can dig and save the bulb, but it would be very rare. Occasionally we have a super mild winter, fairly dry, and the bulbs do survive through the winter and come up, but that's probably not more than once out of every 10 or 15 years. So if you're hoping to save them, take real good care of them in the growing season, and then dig those bulbs before we start having freezing weather.
Okay. Thank you for all your help today, Bob, and I enjoy your show.
I sure appreciate it, Jan. Thank you, and you have a wonderful weekend. Let's see here. We better get a break out of the way. Maggie's going to be up next, but Don, run those recordings, and we'll be back to phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. We're going to talk to Maggie and Robert and Gary, and Maggie is up first. Good morning, Maggie.
Well, good morning to you.
Good morning.
To get on, it seems to be a tree day today. My question is, well, I guess it's a comment. I got in on the last part of the conversation between you and Howard Garrett yesterday about elm trees. No,
yes.
Not elm trees. Maple trees.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I live like in Chavano Park, just north, just right at 1604. Mm-hmm. And wanted to plant some maple trees, but I'm hearing that may be not the best thing.
Well, just realize that there are many, many different kinds of maple trees, and there are a handful of them that can be planted. I guess you could call them shade trees, but they really don't make monstrous trees in our part of the country. But some of them, like the big tooth maple, the Caddo maple, those are maples that are native to Texas. Big tooth is the one that you see up at Lost Maples State Park. And
right.
those are fine trees to plant. Sometimes they're a little hard to locate, and they will do well in where you are. The closer you get to 1604, it seems like the better the soil gets in the Chavano Park area. There's a lot of that area in central. There you go. But anyway, you could expect to do fairly well with that group of maples, you know, planted as a landscape tree. Now, the so-called Japanese maples, the taller ones are based on Acer palmatum. The more dwarf forms are based on, I think it's Acer dissectum, if I remember right. But those trees really are not real happy in our soils. If you really fortify the soil, lots of organic material, you can grow them in the shade. They don't tolerate the sun very well. And or if you get the really small ones, and again, some of these, what they call the waterfall types, are just incredibly beautiful. And they can actually be grown in a pot. I think Howard Garrett has one of them that he's had in the same ornamental pot in his front yard for like 26 years or something like that. But the bottom line we're coming to is there are lots of different kinds of maples. And to be successful, you just have to choose carefully. And things like the big twos, just plant them out in your yard like you would, you know, other trees. The Japanese types are strictly shade-loving, and just understand how big they're going to get and plant appropriately. Now, what I will tell you, too, about most of your native trees is you're not going to get those incredible crimson colors that you know, see in Oregon or in Vermont, which I've actually never been to see, but you will get a beautiful golden yellow color. And that is their fall color, and they are absolutely spectacular. But if you're looking for the reds and the purple reds, and we could talk about anthocyanins and carotenoid pigments and things like that, and bore the heck out of most of the rest of the world. But just don't set your expectations too really, really high. Now, the little waterfall types, they will have colorful foliage both spring and fall. But again, it's kind of like I tell people about hostas. You'll love hostas if you've never seen them in Pennsylvania. But if once you've seen them, you know, at some of the gardens up there, or if you've ever visited Kew Gardens in London, you'll never be happy with hostas in San Antonio again. But if you don't know what their potential is, they're pretty darn neat plants for the shade. And I kind of have to categorize maples the same way.
All right. So if I'm looking for the big colorful ones. So if I look at the big twos or the Caddo,
those are probably two of the best.
Okay, and I'll probably get a nice yellow color from
them. Golden yellow,
red.
Right.
Any other tree that would give that good color?
Well, I'll make all my native plant friends hate me one more time. For a tree that gets beautiful red color, it's hard to beat the Chinese tallow. It can be a bit invasive. I do not object to these plants inside San Antonio because, you know, I'd never plant them if I lived next door to Frederick Park or somewhere that I was, you know, afraid that they would actually get out and be a problem. But in a residential neighborhood, if you want a beautiful red tree in the fall, look at Chinese tallow. Now, I do have to say I've got some of them on my ranch, and most of them really got hurt with this winter's cold. It was, you know, coldest weather we've had in 30 years, and it was very hard on the tallows. But for a big tree, it would be hard to beat Chinese tallow as far as a colorful tree. Another wonderful lower shrubby plant is flame sumac. And it can be invasive. It spreads with underground runners, rarely gets more than about 10 or 12 feet tall. But if you were looking for another native plant that is going to be easy for you to grow, if you can find flame sumac, it's going to give you color that's equivalent to anything you're going to see anywhere when you're getting those kind of crimson colors for fall color.
Okay. All right. This is great information. Now, one quick question. Chili pekins. Is this the time to go find them, or am I too late?
You should be able to find them. We actually have one grower that's been growing them in gallon containers. I'd have to look and see if we still have them. But visit whatever nursery you usually visit. And you might make calls first before you go, because all the growers stop producing as many of them as we get more into summer. This is certainly the season that if you know anybody that has them sprouting up around their yard, you can certainly go dig and transplant them. But it's certainly a good time to plant them. Finding them may be a little bit more of a challenge, but they should be out there for you.
Well, I appreciate it very much. You're just like God in the plant world. You know,
I would not go that far at all, but
knowledge, you and God, you're fabulous. So, all right, well, thank you very much.
Somebody flattered me one time. Said they were. Their young son had been listening on the radio, and they were driving around and looking at trees, and my friend Robert said his son said, where did the trees come from? And he told his little boy, said, well, God made the trees. And said his son looked at him and said, does he work for Bob Webster? And I said, no, it is very definitely the other way around.
But well, as long as you both impart knowledge, that's the
well,
important part.
And remember who's in charge. You have a
absolutely.
Have a great weekend, Maggie.
You say to you, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. All right. Let's go ahead and talk to Robert. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you this fine day?
I'm great, thank you. Just smiling like always. It's a good Father's
well,
Day.
I would think it is going to be a good one. All the kids will be here.
Excellent.
I always like the meme that shows Mother's Day, you know, where are we taking Mom for dinner? And Father's Day, what are you cooking us for dinner?
And that is a very, very true statement, but I will have to admit some of the dads I know are better than most of the restaurants I know. So it's just it's just goes along with being a guy. What can I say?
Yep. I think I fit in that category, but I'll let everybody speak to that. And I do want to carry the previous caller's comment. I think you're more the Holy Spirit type because you spread the love of gardening. You keep the fire of gardening alive in our hearts. So,
well, I'll take that compliment. I certainly will. Thank you.
Okay. Quick olive trees. I've got olive trees that you know, went to the ground. They were right at 7 years old. So everybody I've spoke to said they don't graft olive trees. The person I got these from, who was a nurseryman and bought these from a nursery, or from a grower, said they were grafted, and they just look grafted. So that's okay. If they are, so be it.
Right.
My question is, now that they're growing back, whether they're good olives or not, I'm going to keep them for a landscape tree or shrub.
Mm-hmm.
Should I treat that kind of like a pomegranate or a fig, cut it back to 4 or 5? I'm going to keep it as a bush if I can. I don't want to
treat. Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. That's going to be by far the most productive. And, you know, most of the olives that I'm familiar with are grown from cuttings. So genetically, they are the same as, you know, same genetics as you would get. You get the same benefits you get from grafting, but they're on their own roots. So it's possible some people are grafting olives, but most of the people I know, you know, were actually cutting grown trees. So sometimes it takes a little bit longer to develop a really strong root system, but I'll keep my fingers crossed that yours are actually cutting grown, and sometimes they look about the same, but in either event.
Okay, well, that's what we'll hope.
Yeah.
But my biggest question is, as far as fruit producing, does the clock start over again?
No.
Okay.
No, and see, that's the reason that most grafting is done on fruit trees, because you graft a mature wood onto a seedling tree, but that mature wood has already gone through the maturation process. It's just got new wheels, so to speak. It does not start over. The only time it would start over is if you were germinating a seed and growing it up from seed.
So that would feed to the theory that these have not been grafted because they did not. I have a regular bearing and a propagating tree next to one another. Last year was the first time in year 6 the propagating tree budded out. It didn't fruit, but it had. Mm-hmm. So that being the case, I would have to lean towards they're not grafted or they would have produced fruit years ago.
That would make total sense. Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, well, like I say, I'm going to keep them regardless because they're pretty trees, and I have nothing else really I want to put where they are. So I'll just, even if they produce garbage olives, I'll leave them for the tree
well,
to look at.
They're very attractive as a landscape plant, and I think you're on the right track, and glad they're coming back for you.
Likewise. You know, after 7 years, it was like, you got to be kidding me.
Well, it's like I always liken to, I may have a 900-pound bull calf out there, but until he matures, you know, he's not going to be doing what he needs to do with a heifer. So plants just the same way. It has to reach that degree of maturity. And while we were laughing at other semi-religious comments, I'll have to tell you one I really enjoyed talking to Malcolm Beck one time. Malcolm had made his first trip out to California and actually been maybe Muir Woods or somewhere and seen the big redwoods. And he said to me, Bob, that was like going to church. And I said, no, Malcolm, that was going to church.
See,
so you get out,
face,
you get out and enjoy.
I stand by my earlier comment.
Well, you get out and enjoy your Sunday and your Father's Day, and look forward to visiting again sometime, Robert. Thank you so much.
All right, have a great day, sir.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. All right, Gary, hang on. We need to get a little break in here, and then we'll be right back with more phone calls on The Garden Show.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right. My next three callers are going to be Gary and Gilbert and Harry. I should mention one more thing. Dr. Kirby's show will be a best of show today. Talked to him yesterday afternoon, and he's simply overwhelmed with some clinic issues. So you get to hear a great, great pet show today, as you always do on Sundays here on KTSA. But you'll have to save your questions to call in next week when I think we'll be back doing the show together. But anyway, just give you that heads up. Right now, let's get back to gardening. It's going to be Gary, Gilbert, and Harry, and Gary's first. Good morning, Gary.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Bob. Thank you.
Good morning.
Hey, I live down in the Sugar Land area.
Yes, sir.
I need to know how many chill hours we had this year. Do you know where I would find that information?
The only ones who might have it would be the National Weather Service. I don't think your extension agents keep up with it. It wouldn't hurt to call. And in both cases, those guys live on our tax money, so don't hesitate to ask. But I'd probably start the extension service, may be easier to get hold of. But I think the National Weather Service keeps those records, and that would probably be your most accurate source, and that would be where your extension agents would be getting the information. I will tell you that if you are seriously interested in it, there are little recording thermometers. If you ever wanted to be able to record and calculate exactly how many chilling hours you had in your orchard or around your garden or whatever, there are several of them out there now that do that. They use them in the oil field for various purposes. So if you ever get really, really, really into this, you can figure your own. But to know how much we got in a given year, probably National Weather Service or your extension agent would be the two best places to check.
Okay, we have a garden center and a landscape company, and for the last 15 or 20 years, we've been bringing the dirt back from landscape jobs, tree planting, uh-huh. and piling it up. And we have a hill probably 20, 25 feet tall.
Wow.
And one side of it we don't go to very often, we discovered a peach tree that is 15 to 20 feet tall and round. It's a big bush.
Multiple
trunks, and it has a bunch of peaches on it. It hadn't been watered, fertilized, or cared for in, ever. And we just know, I'd like to know how many chill hours we have that might have made this thing produce peaches this year.
Yeah, that's outstanding. Yeah, and they're good peaches?
Well, they're about the size of a golf ball right now.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's, that will be the other criteria is, does it produce a quality, tasty peach? And, only time will tell. But the fact that it did bloom and produce fruit, number one, it tells you it's a mature tree. And number two, tells you that, it got the amount of chill hours it needs. So, let's keep our fingers crossed that that fruit ripens to something that you'll enjoy having on the table.
It must have been growing for at least 5 or 6 years without any care at all, and it's amazing how much trouble some people have growing trees.
Well, keep in mind, you're in an area with a little bit better soil and a little bit better moisture most of the time, so it wound up in the right place, but let me know what you figure out. I'll be interested in hearing.
We have mostly gumbo, and this tree is growing around chunks of concrete and other things that we bought. Brought back from the landscape job, so I'm going to call it a miracle peach.
Well, it sounds like a good name for a good tree. Let me know how the fruit matures and how it tastes, Gary. I'll very much be interested in hearing.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate your show.
My pleasure. Thank you. All right, next up will be Gilbert. Good morning, Gilbert.
Morning, Bob.
Morning,
Happy
sir.
Thursday.
And to you as well.
Thank you, sir.
I'm just calling because I bought a avocado tree from the from Rainbow Gardening.
Right.
Over there in Madera.
Right.
And it was real beautiful until like 5 days ago. Of course it was in the pot. And
right.
I went ahead and put it in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And it was beautiful for a month or a month and a half. And then I went on vacation last week and I came back and the leaves were starting to dry out. And this morning they're all, looks like it's dying. What do you think is happening?
I think it probably got too dry while you went out of town because we have gotten into some very dry, very windy, very drying weather. And the fact that this was a fairly new tree probably just wasn't very well established. Now, I doubt that it was killed. I suspect it will come back out. As you may have heard me talking to a caller earlier, don't overdo it with watering. I mean, water it very thoroughly. But the thing that will really help that avocado tree is every time you think about it, pick up the hose and just spray up and down the limbs of the tree because it will absorb a lot of moisture directly through that bark. And I do that. You can do it three times a day if you had the opportunity to. When it does need watering again, I would add maybe a little bit of Super Thrive or a little bit of Hastagrow or a little bit of Garrett juice to the water that you use to water that tree. But you're probably going to have a lot of leaves fall off. When a tree gets too dry, the leaves tend to yellow and drop. It's always a good sign if they drop. If things turn brown and stay attached to the tree, that's a bad sign. But having them yellow and drop just says, hey, I got drier than I liked, and then it'll put on some new leaves, which I think is probably what's going to happen with your avocado.
Oh, well, I hope that comes true. That's my third avocado tree that I plant, and it's the first two, I threw them out of a seed,
mm-hmm.
and once they get to like 2 feet tall, they're so beautiful,
and then
all of a sudden they just die.
Well, again, when you're growing from a seed, you're growing an avocado that came out of California, and things transplanted from California don't normally take real well in Texas. We'll just leave it at that. But when you get one of the varieties, what you're getting when you buy from Rainbow or Fanix or anybody else that carries avocados, you're actually getting a varieties of avocado out of Mexico where they are grown and they are a little bit more tolerant of our soils, and they are certainly a little bit more cold hardy. So this one has the best chance of the three of not only surviving but producing for you. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
That's right. Yeah. I know this one that was it's grafted, so I said I'm going to have a better chance with this one than.
Oh, yeah. When you're getting those Haas avocados or Calavo avocados out of California, they're absolutely delicious, but they simply don't grow here. So you have a much better chance now, but do like I say, just every time you think about it, pick up the trunk and spray up and down the limbs of the tree, because even though the roots got damaged from being a little too dry, it can absorb a lot of water directly through the bark, and that'll help pull it through a lot faster.
All right, Bobby. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Gilbert. Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Have a nice day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. Let's get our last break of the show out of the way here, Don, so we know exactly how much time we have left. Our first caller when we come back will be Harry.
I woke up crying late at night when I was very young. I had dreamed my father had passed away and gone. My world revolved around him. I couldn't lie there anymore. So I made my way down the mirrored hall and tapped upon his door. And I said, Daddy, I'm so afraid. How will I go on with you gone that way? Don't want to cry anymore, so may I stay with you.
And Don gives us a good Father's Day song, where we usually get our Sunday fishing song, but this being Father's Day, that's just highly, highly appropriate. hope your dads are still with you wherever you are, and those of us who's have gone on to a better place, well, we always remember them on a day like this. So that's what Father's Day is all about. We got a few more minutes to talk gardening. It's going to be Harry and Karen and JC. That'll probably be as many as we can get in. So good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
That was depressing as hell, bro.
Well, it's
I'm
life.
Fishing to go out to the cemetery and see my dad anyway and have a beer with him.
That's a good thing to do.
Homeboy, I can't remember his name up in Comfort, used to fill in for you. Is he still around with us?
You know, interestingly, his name's Bruce Dooley. He's back in this area. He moved out to West Texas for a while, out in the Alpine area, and he's doing. He has had his own radio show, and he's doing a lot of podcasts and things. Now he's not on the major, the big time stations, but Bruce is reasonably healthy, highly active, and still has that great mind going. So go to natureapproved@yahoo.com, or maybe just Google Nature Approved, and you can find out where Bruce's shows and podcasts are available.
Awesome, man. Thank you very much.
That all you needed today?
Yeah, I guess the doctor's not going to be in. I got some Cat 101 stuff I needed to talk about, but that's not going to happen this weekend.
Well, I trust Dan will be back with us back in, I say in studio, that means sitting in over here at Shades of Green looking out the window at a beautiful setting, but so far as I know, he'll be back next week, and hope the kitty cast questions can last till then.
Yeah, the cats are a never-ending story, man.
They are, the cats are unique. I mean, some people, I think cats are smarter than some people and they don't get along well with them. Lots of us just smile and don't try to figure them out. I mean, I love what Dan says about cats. He says, the shortest book ever written is What We Know About Cat Psychology. So I think you and I feel the same way about our feeline friends, but, you do have a very happy Father's Day and, I look forward to visiting again.
Let's get your other caller in there before it's too late.
Very good. And you get hold of Bruce Dooley, and he's still around going strong and putting out some really good information about plants and the environment both. So appreciate it, Harry. And Don, let's move on to Karen. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I live in Northeast Austin, and
okay.
I just discovered a couple of little starts of poison ivy. So I have two things I need your help with. Anything that you could recommend that would actually get rid of poison ivy the safest possible way? And also, a friend had given me a tree that makes little tiny apple-like fruits. I have no idea what the tree is. It's a mm-hmm. good shade tree, but it is suckering all over the place. And I don't know how to get rid of the suckers.
Well, I can okay, the second question first, you're probably looking at a native tree called a Blanco crabapple. And crab apples, they're actually edible. I don't know a lot of people that eat them, but the one, and it is a popular native tree. It does have beautiful fall color, and it does produce lots of little crab apples, but it does sucker like mad. And the ways to kind of retard the suckering, put down, a heavy native mulch. I had a caller yesterday. We were talking about this. It was just at her wit's end. And I was telling her, if you have old cardboard boxes or things like that, you can put those on top of the ground. I do not recommend weed block or plastic fabric, but you can put something like some newspaper, some cardboard, whatever else down. The ones that are already up and growing, I get after them with a grubbing hoe. I don't have the crab apple, but I have a couple other trees that sucker badly.
Well,
and just about all you can do is chop them out.
These suckers are actually coming up about 20 feet away between pavers that I have.
Yeah.
The tree
yeah.
itself, totally surrounded by deck
mm-hmm.
and so, or a sidewalk. So it's not suckering at the tree itself that much. It's just all over my yard and
yeah.
between pavers.
That's the price you pay for planting the blank old crab apple. But they do have pretty flowers in the spring, and I guess they have some redeeming qualities, but you've just identified why I don't have any of them in my landscape. But
I didn't know what it was when he gave it to me.
A physical barrier is what you're going to need. To the poison ivy. Poison ivy is a woody vine. And, of course, any time if you find it necessary to handle it in any way, wear rubber gloves, dishwashing gloves of some sort. Do not ever wear leather gloves when you're working with poison ivy, because you'll get that sap into the leather, and it will continue to be a source of irritation, shall we say. But with something like a dishwashing glove, you can wash the sap off. And it's hard at first to totally eliminate. You just have to be persistent with it. Cut it off at ground level. When it comes out, spray it with that orange oil vinegar mix we talk about. Just mix up a small amount. Doesn't take much, but take your strong vinegar, your 20% vinegar, and to a quart of that, you'd add about a tablespoon of orange oil. Spray that anywhere you see the poison ivy coming up. It'll kill it back. It'll probably sprout out a second time. Kill it back. It'll probably sprout out. About the third time you spray and kill it back, then it kills it completely. But I don't know, even the really toxic herbicides that I don't recommend, I don't know anything that'll kill poison ivy without killing your oak trees and other things around. So cut it down low. Let it sprout up, and again, the vinegar orange oil herbicide, use that. Probably be about 2 months, it'll sprout up again. Use it again. By about the third time, it'll stop coming back.
Okay, and does it come up when you kill it at the original site? Will it come up somewhere else then?
Not usually. Not usually. Now, if you just moved into a place out in the country and you had a 30-year-old vine of poison ivy, you might have an issue with that. But doesn't sound like that's the case, so I doubt that it's going to come up anywhere else. Maybe right in the immediate area, but I doubt it's going to go beyond where you're seeing it now.
So a tablespoon of orange oil and a quart of straight 20% vinegar?
Yes. Now, if you had a big area to do, and you could cut that back to a teaspoon in a pint, it's just once you mix your orange oil and vinegar, it doesn't keep. So I don't want you to mix up. Now, you may have other weeds you want to go spray and kill with it, but just don't ever mix up more than you think you will use, because you can't store it. It'll blow the top off the container and not remain good as a weed killer. So just try to mix up only the amount you need.
Oh, okay, good to know. All right, well, thank you for all the things you help people with. I listen, and I'm glad I can get your radio station, so appreciate you very much.
We appreciate it, and, of course, lots of folks, you can listen to KTSA on the Internet if you ever have a day when the reception's real bad or something, and it makes me have to be careful, because sometimes I think I'm talking to somebody from Texas, but they might be from Oklahoma or even Pennsylvania. So I'm glad you can pick up the signal, but if signal ever gets weak, then, again, just go to KTSA.com, or if you're telling somebody around the country about what you enjoy, they can join us anywhere over the Internet. So, Karen, I appreciate it. And, Don, let's get JC in here to finish out the show. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Should be a short question answer. Tomatoes, best varieties for growing in 10-gallon pots.
Okay.
And this is for a friend who's never grown anything, but I'm going to help him get started. I've been listening to you since you started back in the 80s. So I've taken copious notes, and I've been successful, but my friend is not a gardener, and he's very impatient. So this is going to be a birthday present that we're going to plant in this month in June.
Okay.
He's going to want production starting in July.
Okay, so we're going to want to go with cherry tomatoes, small fruited tomatoes, and we're going to go with indeterminate types, because they basically make a vine that will grow and produce until it freezes. And if I were going to two varieties that I would look for, One of them is Sun Gold. Sun Gold is a little yellow cherry tomato. I mean, I had four of them ripe yesterday. Mine are just starting to produce, and they got picked and eaten. Don't tell anybody else because I have friends who would like me to bring some, and I'll do that before too long. But Sun Gold is an outstanding, fast-producing, long-producing tomato plant. The second one, if he wants a red tomato, Sweet 100.
Okay.
Is I think is the best red cherry. Now sneak in addition to that, sneak in at least one big fruited tomato. Big fruited tomatoes don't make fruit in the middle of the summer when the night temperatures are high. But if you want to keep them occupied with a couple of cherry tomatoes while you sneak in a big fruited type that you can have for a slicing tomato this fall, then look for Celebrity. I think that's the single easiest and best of the big fruited slicing tomatoes. And once you get started, I'll recommend several others. But for now, Sweet 100 and Sun Gold and maybe a Celebrity.
Awesome. Bob, thanks again for all you've done for us over the years.